18, 41 degrees. Now, 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Those of you who tuned in to the Thursday morning show perhaps tuned in expecting to hear Nan Calvert paying her monthly visit to the morning show. Unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties earlier in the week. They worsened on Wednesday and forced the truncation of Wednesday's morning show. And we had timely topics that really needed to be heard as quickly as possible. So we shifted Nan to today's morning show one day later. And so we trust that you have found us and found her. And Nan Calvert has brought someone with her today who can speak to one of the topics that is nearest and dearest to Nan's heart. So first of all, Nan, we welcome you back to the morning show. And I want you to tell our listeners who you have brought with you today.
I have brought with me today the beautiful and talented Allison Thielen, the program manager for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, because, well, it's that time of year again. It is upon us. Everything is green. Lawn services are out there. People are riding around on their mowers. They are putting herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers on their lawns. And Allison and I happen to have some really interesting information about cutting-edge turf care that people need to hear about. So that is why we're here today.
Very good. So Allison is program manager for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, or Root Pike WIN as it's often known. Remind me how long you've been there.
I've been there since April of 2013.
Very good. And just say a word for our listeners who might not be acquainted, although over the years they've certainly heard plenty about Root Pike WIN. But for a listener who is not acquainted with who you are and what you are, just give it to us in a nutshell.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit organization. We're based out of Racine, but really what we do is we work to restore, protect, and sustain the ecosystems in the five watersheds that are within the Root Pike Basin in southeastern Wisconsin. So we do that by facilitating a number of restoration projects and outreach and education programs, and you know, getting the word out to folks like we're doing right now.
Right. So explain, first of all, what we mean by this term watershed. How are you using that term?
Yeah, a watershed is basically just an area of land where all of the water, all the precipitation flows to the same stream or water body. So, for instance, you know, we're here in the Pike Creek watershed. Nearby is the Pike River watershed, both of which direct into Lake Michigan.
And so what were you saying about five different areas within this watershed?
Yeah, the Root Pike Basin contains five different watersheds, which are kind of topographic features. And so there's the Root River watershed, which is, and the mouth is in Racine. We've got the Pike River watershed and Pike Creek watersheds, which are both empty out in Kenosha County. And then we also have Oak Creek watershed and the Wind Point watershed.
And I think we've talked about this before, but within that area, then, is everything part of one of those watersheds?
Yes.
Okay. And nothing is ever part of more than one?
Correct, right.
Pretty much by definition.
Right, right. Basically, there will be a topographic, you know, like a ridge, essentially, that is a boundary between watersheds. And so if you imagine a pointed say, a pointed mountain. And if water is going to fall on top of that mountain, it's going to go fall either on one side or the other side of the mountain. And that's similar to what a topographic ridge would do for a watershed, is the water is going to go one way or the other and eventually make its way either by, storm sewers or, just cross the land through the groundwater table to the nearest stream, which then all of ours empty into Lake Michigan.
Right. So what is it about the action of a watershed or what occurs within a watershed that makes it of such acute environmental importance? I mean, why are people who are environmentally conscious or environmentally sensitive supposed to even think about something like a watershed?
Well, I guess the overarching idea that people should remember is that what happens on the land ends up in the water. And so, when we look at this kind of watershed by watershed, whatever happens at the headwaters, is eventually going to make its way downstream. And so if we kind of look at the watershed as a whole organism, a whole body there, then, things that we do, practices on our own properties, things with yard care, making sure that our autos are not leaking oil and things like that. There's all kinds of things that we can all do and that, farmers can do and that industries that can do just to prevent additional pollutants from being entered into the streams in the watersheds.
So that's what this is about more than anything, is keeping our water clean.
Correct.
And doing things on land to keep our water clean. I mean, and I guess that's why it's important to talk about this and explain this, because probably a lot of people think keeping our water pure means don't take this thing and dump it into the water. This is about, in a sense, more subtle and maybe even rather invisible ways in which we affect the purity of the water by what we're doing sometimes nowhere near where the water is.
Correct, yeah. The vast majority of water pollution is caused by just stormwater runoff. And so essentially whenever it rains or even, when it snows in the winter and that snow melts, that precipitation or that water is going to carry anything it comes across into the nearest stream through the storm sewers or however else it gets there.
So we are recording this interview, for instance, on Thursday morning, and a really ferocious storm came through, much of Wisconsin last night, carrying really, really high winds and also some really, really torrential rains. So potentially what happened last night, Wednesday night, with this terrible storm in terms of the kind of things that would give you concern?
Yeah, well, we get these storms of great intensity these days, and they seem to be getting more intense as time goes on. And what happens when we get that much precipitation at such a quick rate is that, it will make its way into the storm sewers. We've got all these, pipe systems, these gray infrastructure systems that essentially were created years ago to get the water out of residential areas as quickly as possible, which makes sense when you think about it. You don't want flooding and such, but it's replacing nature's process. And what happens then is all this water is rushing into these gray tunnels. It's shooting out the outfalls and into the streams, and it's essentially blasting out the banks of the streams, causing a lot of erosion. It's too much water too fast, and so it's kind of carving out the banks of the streams and adding a whole lot of sediment to the water, and it's not good for the organisms that live in the water. In addition, all of that precipitation, water is an extreme force, and it can cause great damage, but it can also carry along many things with it. So it's picking up anything from grass clippings from people who've just, mowed their lawn, especially if they piled them up somewhere near the curb. It's picking up things like pesticides, fertilizers, dog poop is a big one. It's oil that's dripping from cars. There's all kinds of things that this water is picking up. Essentially anything that's, laying around could possibly be carried off by this stormwater and deposited directly into our streams.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Allison was saying. In the summertime, in the springtime, in the fall time, the idea of out of sight, out of mind comes into play. People don't see what's on our roads, people on their driveways, on our sidewalks, in our lawns, and all those places. And so you don't think that anything is being picked up and carried off by stormwater runoff. But if you think back to winter, when we've had a significant amount of snow, and all the big piles of snow in parking lots, it turns gray and then it turns black with each successive plowing. that's what's running off into our waterways. There's a physical illustration of it in the wintertime. And it's pretty startling sometimes when you drive around and you see these very large, filthy piles of snow.
So in other words, what the stuff that discolors our snow is stuff that's always there. That's not the fact that it discolors the snow is obviously that's a winter thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what's discoloring the snow is always there.
It's always there. And then you combine, all of the stuff that gets thrown onto the ground, like gum and cigarette butts and all of the things that end up there. And it all goes into our waterways. It all goes into the stormwater sewer system, unchecked, unfiltered. And there it goes.
For those of you just joining us, we have Nan Gobert with us for her monthly visit to the morning show, and with her is Allison Thielen, Program Manager for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, or Root Pike WIN. So we are talking about the health of our watershed, and we'll be getting in a moment into some practical things that all of us can do that can help eliminate some of this damaging stormwater runoff and other issues that can affect the quality of our water. I don't remember in these conversations if we've ever really spent any time talking about one of Allison's first points, which was the storm sewer system that we have in place, which you mentioned was put in place a long time ago and probably before we fully understood a lot of this or a lot of the ramifications of this. Are there serious efforts underway to alter that system at all? Or is that, first of all, is that not a particular concern of Root Pike WIN for whatever reason? Or is that not a particularly feasible thing to think about in terms of somehow altering that storm sewer system in a way that the way it operates would do a little less damage?
I think in most of our local municipalities, there aren't any major infrastructure changes happening to the storm sewer system itself, but rather more of them are adopting new things to put into place to offset the issues with the storm sewer systems. And so, things like bioswales are being put in, naturalized stormwater detention basins, and, things like that will essentially help hold back some of that stormwater that would otherwise be flying into those storm sewers, and also kind of infiltrating it and helping to filter it out before it gets there.
Okay. So we should take the storm sewer system as it is currently constructed as a given. And in your mind, it's not worth working towards altering that. Is that what you're saying?
I think the astronomical cost of probably replacing an entire system like that is what prevents that from happening, whereas there's all these things that we can do that we can get grants for and that even municipalities may be able to put into their budget that they can do, like I said, to kind of offset some of that, to hold back some of that water, to help some of it infiltrate into the groundwater table rather than having it just run off across the land.
Right. Can you say a little bit more about I'm not sure if it's the same thing with two different names or a couple of different things, but what you just mentioned as something that a municipality could do with basins or bioswales?
Sure,
I think you
said. Sure. Yeah, yeah. So a bioswale, often they're installed in medians of roads. And so you've got the median, and they'll have curb cuts, and so the stormwater will flow off the roads and directly into these medians, which are then they're carved out, so they're a depression in the ground, and they're
lower than the roadways.
Right, so they can kind of fill up with the stormwater, and they're planted with hopefully native species, but sometimes other types of perennials and such that the roots can then help filter out and infiltrate some of that water. And there usually is a storm drain in the bottom of those bioswales, but by the time the water gets to those, a lot of it has already been filtered out by the plants, and it's just kind of the amount that the plants can't take care of is what ends up going into the storm system.
And what do we call that?
That's a bioswale.
Okay.
Right.
Is that, and then you talked about basins. Is that the same kind of thing?
Right, right. So stormwater detention ponds are not a, they're not a super modern invention or anything. They've been around for a long time. But a lot of them in the past have been lined with concrete, and a lot of them still are now. But really the movement is to take those basins and to turn them more into naturalized ponds. And so, you're going to add your natural native plants around those. You're going to take out the concrete bottoms to allow, the water to exist in a more natural state. And then there usually is, of course, there's an outfall from whichever subdivision or industrial park it may be draining. But then also there will be a sewer in there as well so that, some of the water can drain out into the storm sewer system.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of a difference do these tend to make? I mean, is this addressing a really significant portion of the problem? I mean, even a majority of the problem?
I wouldn't say a majority of the problem, but I'd say everyone that's put in is a step in the right direction. And I think it's kind of a way to that we're learning to mimic nature's process that we've lost while putting in so many impervious surfaces over the years.
And, you know, they can have, even though we don't see a lot of the things that Allison was talking about in terms of bioswales in our roadways and public parking lots, there are things that people can do in their own landscapes that can mitigate hundreds of thousands of gallons of stormwater runoff, and those things are called rain gardens. And there are a lot of people in Racine and Kenosha counties who have rain gardens, and we all actually enjoy the benefits of those, and we can talk about those a little bit later. But they may be small, but they are mighty, and they can do lots of great good for our waterways.
Right. Before we get to the kind of the private citizen piece of this, which I think is what we want to probably spend almost all of our remaining time talking about, I'm curious about this at the municipal level, and I know you're probably much more directly acquainted with the municipalities in this area, I mean, in Racine County and Kenosha County, but in general, let's say across the state of Wisconsin, I wonder about your level of awareness in terms of what is happening where. And generally speaking, is there a decent amount of concern about this and understanding of this at the municipal level across the state of Wisconsin, or are there large swaths of the state where they're not thinking about this or talking about this at all? Again, at the municipal level is what I'm really after.
Sure. And I think that it greatly depends on the location and size of the municipality in many cases. You know, all of the municipalities that are of a decent size have a stormwater discharge permit from the DNR, and they have a lot of requirements that they need to meet as a part of that permit. And part of what we do is we help 21 municipalities here in southeastern Wisconsin meet the requirements in their permits for public outreach and education. And so that's part of why we come out and we tell people, you know, what they can do on their own properties to help reduce stormwater runoff pollution. But the municipalities themselves, you know, many of them have adopted watershed restoration plans that have been created in the areas for the Pike River plan, say, or Root River plan, even the Wind Point plan. And those watershed plans contain recommendations for restoration projects that are prioritized by essentially the pollutant load that they will be removing from the watershed. And so many of those projects are things, you know, like maybe bioswales or detention basin naturalization, but things also like stream bank restoration, like wetland restoration, brownfield remediation, things like that. And so the municipalities who have adopted those watershed restoration plans then have kind of essentially pledged or promised to follow as many of those recommendations in those plans as they can make work. You know, there's certainly there's a cost to each of the projects that's estimated in the plans, and that's part of why Root Pike Wind exists, is to work alongside the municipalities and help to educate them and get them fired up about the excitement of creating these new places where people want to be, that where we have cleaner water, and also helping them, facilitating the projects for them and helping them find funding sources, serving as sort of a project manager.
When you talk about watershed restoration, what exactly are you talking about? I mean, what exactly is being restored? Are you restoring the quality of the water within that watershed? Is that exactly what's happening there? Is that what that term represents?
In a way, but what we're doing, the way we're doing that is we're restoring the ecosystems. So we're restoring those the process that nature has naturally, and doing that by, you know, putting a buffer in along a stream bank where previously, say, a farmer plowed right up to the edge of the stream. And then, you know, we took some of the land back, or the farmer jumped on board with Root Pike Wind or another group and decided that they were going to do their part by installing, say, a 30 to 50 foot buffer between the stream bank and their cropland. And that would be native plants generally. And those plants would then help filter out a lot of the runoff from the agricultural fields. And that's just one example of how it can be restored.
So in a sense, it is, so when we're talking about the watershed, now we're talking about the land. mm-hmm. and we're talking about restoring, in a sense, the topography of the land, or in a sense, restoring it to how it was before we got here and intervened and altered it.
Right, yeah. And when you say topography, I mean, yeah, sometimes it is a major undertaking, some of these projects. One instance is the Pike River, the north branch of the Pike River, which is the portion of it that lies in Racine County. The village of Mount Pleasant undertook a huge restoration project that's been going on for almost 20 years now, and that they've essentially started at the headwaters up in Mount Pleasant, and they restored that portion of the river. It had been completely channelized, so it was a straight shot, which causes a lot of erosion issues. A channel like that doesn't allow fish to rest, and that causes a lot of issues with their life cycles.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of invasive species had taken over, and essentially what they did, and this is why topography, you know, reminded me of this, is they re-meandered the stream. So they went in, you know, with some heavy machinery and literally recreated the meanders of the stream, and added in some, you know, a wetland area. There's some ponds and such. Really created a beautiful area of all native plants, where you see some remarkable wildlife out there now, and there's recreational trails. But really, it's an incredible thing that I welcome people to, you know, go visit and then really think about what it would be like if the restoration and the walking trails were to be extended down into Kenosha County as well.
Right. Where is this exactly again?
The Pike River, it's basically the Pike River, as soon as it crosses from Kenosha County to the Racine County line, which is right near Petrifying Springs Park, just mm-hmm. north of there. And so from that point all the way to the headwaters of the Pike River, which is near Old Spring Street in Racine County, that's the restoration stretch of the stream there.
Interesting.
It's beautiful. I mean, the degree of quality of life it has added to that area is just remarkable. There are walking trails, and it's brought people out into the community. It's something, it's a real jewel. It's something that everybody can be proud of. And again, everyone benefits from this project.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, we have Nan Calvert with us in the studios today for the morning show for her monthly visit. And along with her, Allison Thielen, Program Manager for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, or Root Pike WIN. Before we get into the private citizen thing, I want you to explain the term brownfield remediation. So what is meant by a brownfield, first of all, and then what is necessary to remediate such a brownfield?
A brownfield is an area where an industrial plant or factory, something like that, once stood, and it is where the ground is contaminated. And so essentially there was something toxic that was either purposefully or accidentally being leached into the ground during the time that structure was there. And sometimes the structure is still there, but often it's a vacant piece of land. And so that's an area where you know that, you know, if you were to build something there, that land would first have to be capped off or otherwise, you know, we'd have the toxins need to be removed, or they need to be encapsulated so that they cannot be leached out into the water.
So that's an expensive proposition, I should think.
Most likely.
Yeah. Wow. So it's better if we don't get to that point where that kind of thing is necessary.
Correct.
Well, I know that what you are especially anxious to talk about today, and we should, I think we have time to do this fairly thoroughly, is to talk about some of the things that citizens can do with their own property to make a really dramatic difference in all of this. Where should we begin?
Boy, well, with all this rain, I don't know about everybody else, but my grass is growing like crazy. And so I think we need to talk to people about lawn care. You know, something as yeah. simple as lawn care that almost everybody does. There's a lot of things that we can all do to do it in a more eco-friendly way, that we will be, you know, essentially having healthier soils and healthier lawns with less weeds and less chemicals and cleaner water all at the same time.
So what's involved in accomplishing all of that?
Yeah, it sounds like a big undertaking, but, you know, it's really not that bad. I think my first recommendation for anyone who's interested in having a healthier lawn, especially in a more eco-friendly way, would be to have a soil test done. And soil testing is a pretty simple process. It involves taking a core of soil out of your yard, and you can often do it in several different places so that you can get a good good sampling, and sending it into a soils lab. Currently, I believe there's only one option for that in this part of Wisconsin, and that there's the UW Soils Lab. So they have a website. It's easy to go on there. The cost is very insignificant for the soil analysis, and you'll essentially ship them your samples, and within 2 weeks, they will either mail you or email you your results of your soil analysis, and it will tell you things like the nutrient content, the pH, the organic matter content of your soil, some really helpful information, and typically the top half of the report they'll give you is pretty scientific, and so for the average citizen, it may not be real easily translatable. But the second half is the very helpful part of the report, because they will provide for you in plain language recommendations for what to do to improve your soil. So they're either going to tell you, you need more organic matter in your soil, and we recommend that you do some core cultivation and spread compost across your soil. Or they'll say, you have a nitrogen deficiency, and we recommend that you use a single nutrient fertilizer to help replenish that nutrient in your soil. But more often than not, what we're finding is that people are having the soil test done after years of, traditional fertilization and other treatments to their lawn, and their lawn is not lacking anything. And therefore, they are paying a company or something to come out and to do these fertilizing treatments, several times a year, and they don't need to.
Because they're wasting their money.
They're wasting their money.
They're damaging the environment.
That's true, right? they can spend, $12 or $15 or whatever it is for a simple soil test and find out that they don't even need to hire anyone to do that because their soil already has all the nutrients that it needs. And if it doesn't, they'll be given, recommendations on exactly what to do to improve the soil health. And I think, great thing to mention, again, is the single nutrient fertilizers. They're often recommended by the UW Soils Lab simply because it's just such a direct way to take care of the actual problem. Whereas most fertilizers, they've got like three nutrients in them, and it's a varying balances of the different nutrients. And, you're just kind of putting it on blindly.
Right.
I guess this is what I saw on the shelf. I guess I'll just throw this on my lawn. It's got to improve things, right?
Right.
Whereas you might not need that, or you might only need, nitrogen or whatever it might be.
It almost sounds a little like the way we used to approach something like chemotherapy, where it used to be a kind of a one-size-fits-all, a very blunt instrument by which to try to attack the cancer. And, of course, now we've come to be much wiser about it and try to focus chemotherapy in ways that are specific to the patient and specific to the cancer at hand and so on, but not this blanket thing that kills so much and makes the person sick and this and that. I mean, in a sense, we need to be as wise about this as we have become wiser about something like chemotherapy.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great analogy.
This health of the soil, does that matter to the watershed apart from the issue of maybe you don't have to fertilize as much? Are there other ways in which the health of the soil matters directly to what we're talking about?
Yes, because healthier soil will support deeper roots. And, even with turf grass, where turf grass roots, I mean, we've all seen rolls of sod, right? So you can just imagine the roots of turf grass are often an inch, maybe 2 inches deep. When you've got compacted soil that hasn't, been aerated for a long time, when you've got soil that doesn't have a lot of organic matter in it, what you're getting is those roots are going to stay very, very short and compact. The thatch layer is going to be very thick. There's not going to be a lot of oxygen or really water penetrating that soil because it's forming almost a barricade. During a really heavy rain, some of us might notice on our lawns that the water is running off our lawn and not soaking in, And so that's kind of a good example of how, these shallow little roots on hard compacted soil isn't all that much better than a driveway or a parking lot as far as, letting water soak in.
Interesting. So the roots make that big a difference, and it's just the kind of thing we don't think about. And the quality of the soil has a lot to do with whether or not the roots will be healthy or not.
Correct.
Yeah. Wow. I suspect that you're also going to tell us that the choice we make in terms of the type of grass we use is a huge factor here.
It is. It is. Now, those of us who want a traditional lawn, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I would say just be very careful that you are purchasing grass seed. If you're putting in something new, purchase grass seed that is specific to the conditions of where you're planting it. That will allow you to have the healthiest lawn possible in that area. But there's also alternatives to traditional lawns, which I love to promote to people. One of those, if you still like to have kind of the green grass look, one of them is to have a no-mow lawn. And sometimes people's, you know, kind of perk up a little bit when I say no mow, because that's really what it is no mow is it's a blend of fescue grasses, which have much deeper roots than a traditional turf grass lawn. Some of them go up to 12 inches down, and they're very fine roots that create channels through the soil for water to trickle down. And also, this is a grass that is soft and wispy, doesn't look a whole lot different than a regular turf grass lawn would look, but it only grows about 4 to 6 inches high throughout the entire season. And so essentially, if you don't want to, you don't have to mow it. You know, most municipalities, I think their limit is about 6 inches for the longest your grass can be before that you might be fined or something. Mm. But this grass, it does put up seed heads in the fall, and many people do choose to mow it one time in the fall just to cut the seed heads down and make it look more like a regular lawn again. But it's great for you during a heavy rain. You will not see that water running off that lawn. It will all be soaking in. It's almost like turning your whole lawn into it's not as effective as a rain garden, but it's much, much better than a turf grass lawn.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good
so
to know.
No mow fescue grass. Highly recommend it.
Good to know.
There are also, if I might add, a couple of species of native grasses that actually can form a turf-like area. It grows, you know, just like a traditional turf grass lawn, but it's actually native, and one of those is sweetgrass. So you can plant an entire lawn in sweetgrass. It has even longer roots than the no-mow or low-mow lawn, and so even more water filtration. It's native, which is a good thing. You don't have to fertilize it. You don't have to mow it if you don't want to, and it's a really terrific alternative. Plus, if you do mow it or when you step on it, it has this amazing aroma, which is why it's called sweetgrass. So that's another alternative.
Yeah. And Allison's already mentioned native plants more than once.
Mm-hmm.
What is the magic of native plants when it comes to what we're talking about today? What is it about native plants that, in a sense, equips them to deal more effectively, for instance, with a lot of water?
It's their root systems. So sometimes native plants, depending upon the species, can have root systems that go down 11, 12, 13 feet underground. And almost all of our native plants, particularly the grasses and the open land or prairie plants, have very extensive root systems. So what happens is that it forms channels underground so that water can infiltrate the soil, run along the root channels, and go back down into the underground aquifers where it's actually supposed to go. This situation that we've created with all of this impervious surface is actually highly deranged and unnatural. Water really isn't supposed to sheet off to the degree that it does. It's actually supposed to sheet off just a little bit.
Right.
The vast majority of it is supposed to go down underground. But we've changed that with our building practices, our roads, and all of those kinds of things. But given the fact that there are countless acres in turf grass, we can begin remedying that by what we plant in our yards and how we address what we've planted. Even putting in a small native plant garden, even if it isn't, you know, by definition a rain garden, will help things tremendously. Put in a small a native garden and run your downspout into it. Better yet, put in a rain garden somewhere on your property, run your downspout into it. Again, the data tells us unequivocally that rain gardens can mitigate hundreds of thousands of gallons of stormwater runoff every year. So it seems perhaps, you know, when you look at the big picture, it seems like a small thing, but sometimes small things are extremely effective. And when you put them together over neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood, it makes an enormous difference. How we address our swales, you know, in our neighborhoods, those ditches where the water runs through the culverts. We can plant those up with wetland species that help it infiltrate rather than running off. So there are so many things we can do to slow the flow
right.
and also clean the flow before it runs off somewhere.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to me, years ago, we had to, because this was actually happening, we had to go to the sewers on our streets where it runs off along the curb and stencil that it either, you know, don't dump here or runs directly into the lake, because people don't get that this is directly connected to a local pond, river, stream. So when you dump paint into that, when you dump chemicals into that, it's going somewhere.
Right.
It doesn't go to the magic land of away. And it's yeah. mind-boggling to me that, you know, we're not taught that. We don't have a deep understanding of that, so much so that you have to tell people, you know, don't dump your unused paint in here.
Right.
It's just incredible to me.
The things that should go without saying but can't go without saying.
But we're not, you know, we're not taught it anywhere along
right.
the way.
Absolutely.
So, you know. Yeah, but now we are.
Right, absolutely. Speaking up, yes, absolutely. Any other advice for the typical homeowner or private citizen?
We've got lots, and I'm sure we're going to get into much more of it. I wanted to just comment on a few things Nan said with some fun statistics. So, you know, with rain gardens, what we found is that for every square foot of rain garden, it's able to infiltrate between 40 and 50 gallons of rainwater per year, which may not sound like a lot, but the typical residential rain garden is usually between 100 and 400 square feet. So we're talking, you know, up to 16,000 gallons of stormwater could possibly be diverted from the stormwater system just in somebody's front yard each year.
Wow, which just is in a yard.
Yeah, right, in one yard. So, I mean, you know, if one person does it, it might not seem like it's making a huge difference. But, again, this is all, you know, cumulative effect. If many people adopt these practices and install these things in their yards, you know, they're improving life for everyone around them, and it's making a bigger difference, you know, the more people that do it.
Right. So what does a rain garden typically look like? I mean, for somebody who's never even seen one or seen a picture of one or doesn't realize they've seen one. First of all, just at a glance, what does it look like? Does it look like a normal garden?
Well, in many ways, it might look like a wildflower garden to people, especially from a distance. They may not notice anything real significant about it, other than the fact that it's not planted with, you know, annuals and, you know, our very popular perennials. It's planted with native plants, mostly, you know, native prairie plants. And so it's a depressed area in the ground. It's been excavated anywhere between 3 and 8 inches deep, lower than your turf grass, if that is what is surrounding it. And then there's a berm built up around the edge of it that's just to help hold the stormwater in. So then you'll notice that there will be a downspout that's directed into the rain garden. Oftentimes, though, that downspout will be buried under the ground. You know, the extension from the downspout will be buried underground. And we recommend people always do that. And the reason is we had a rain garden grant program for years, and we put in over 100 rain gardens in our 5 watershed areas. And then as part of our deal with our rain garden grants is we would go out for 3 years in a row and monitor the rain gardens and once they were installed. And so many times I would go out, and for the rain gardens that did not have the downspout extension buried, sometimes they would take the above ground extension and remove it from their rain garden, move it out of the way so they could mow their lawn, and then forget to put it back in, essentially cutting off the function of the rain garden completely.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very important that extension be buried, and then it's out of sight, out of mind.
And
you don't think about
it. And it's always there.
Right, right. So the place in the rain garden where the, you know, downspout is emptying in, oftentimes people will put some stones and rocks there to kind of prevent a little bit of erosion from occurring right there, because you want the bottom of your rain garden to be completely flat, and that way the water will spread out evenly throughout the garden. Then it's planted, you know, about one plant per square foot with these native plants. As Nan said, the roots of those can go down 10, 12, 13 feet to really help infiltrate that water. But the plants are, you know, they're native prairie plants. So some of them are, you know, we've got brown-eyed Susans, and there's going to be all kinds of things from, I think, probably 2 or 3 feet high, and then there's things like cup plant might be in there, and that can get up to like 14 feet tall. So it's a you know, not a manicured look, but there are ways to design rain gardens to make them look very aesthetically pleasing and not so wild. If people don't like that wild look and they like more of a landscape design, there's definitely ways to do that even with natural native plants.
Mm-hmm. Who typically puts these in? I mean, are there firms that specialize in this, or Are we getting to the point now where all kinds of places that otherwise do normal landscaping, if you will, are also equipped to do this and happy to do this for people?
Yeah, I do think it's becoming more common. And Nan, you may know more about this than I do. One of our one of the things that we want to do as part of our watershed plans, the recommendations in them, which are more of our programmatic recommendations, is that we want to reach out to more landscaping companies and independent landscapers, and just to help educate them and see how willing they would be to adopt a lot more of these practices in what they do and what they offer to their clients. So, most people I know who have a rain garden have done it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, most of the people that I know have done it themselves. So it's a very easy homeowner thing to do. If you have questions, you can certainly give Root Pike Watershed Initiative call. You can give me a call. I also worked for Root Pike Wind in the field as a advisor and educator for the Rain Garden Initiative, which was many, many years ago. So there are native landscaping firms, design and install firms, that will work with you and help you choose the right plants for your situation. And Wisconsin is lucky to have quite a few of those. So the more we can work with conventional landscapers and get them up to speed in terms of their knowledge base of native plants and their form and function and how to do these things, that would be a wonderful thing. But I would recommend that people actually, work with a native landscaping firm, because they're the go-to people. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to help you with plant selection. The size, the depth, it depends on the type of soil that you have. It also depends upon how much you're trying to mitigate, and that's based on the square footage of your rooftop. Some people also incorporate their driveways, that square footage. Some people just go crazy with it and actually run all of their runoff into the rain garden, or they'll have multiple rain gardens.
Right.
So,
and for somebody who's not in your situation, you live on kind of an acreage, right, out in the country.
Right.
But for someone who's in the city or in the suburbs with just kind of a normal house and a normal sized yard, how big would this rain garden be?
Well, again, it depends upon how many downspouts you're going to run into it. Mm. It's purely based on the amount of impervious surface you're trying to address with stormwater control. So that's a kind of a vague sounding answer,
right,
I know.
Right.
But it just depends on what you're trying to do. Some people will start out with maybe 25% of their roof line, and so perhaps they'll just put in one stormwater runoff garden or rain garden.
Hmm.
And then they'll say, wow, this is really nice. I have so many more butterflies. I have so many more birds, and the colors are amazing, and the leaf structure and the textures. And then they'll say, I'm going to put in another one. And it doesn't have to be in your backyard. It can be in the front yard. So, again, it just depends upon your budget, your energy budget in terms of your ability to do the garden, and what you want to achieve.
Right. Very good.
Right. And, there are some very simple engineering calculations that need to be done in order to put in a rain garden. But I don't want people to be discouraged from doing that on their own, either by the thought of trying to do these engineering calculations or plant selection, because there are some wonderful free resources out there for that information. Certainly, people are more than welcome to call Root Pike Wind or to call Nan to get some advice. But, the DNR and UW Extension put out a great publication. It's a how-to manual for homeowners regarding rain gardens, and it's got everything you would need to know in order to install a rain garden. And there's three components that kind of help determine the size of your rain garden, and that is the slope of the land where you're going to be putting it. It's best to try to locate it on the flattest part of your property. That way your excavation will be simpler,
right,
and you'll have to dig it. You'll be able to dig it shallower than if you did it on a more sloped area. The type of soil, as Nan mentioned, is very important. And also the distance of your rain garden from the downspout to where the rain garden is. Typically, if it's more than 30 feet away, then we're going to assume that your rain garden is not only taking on, of course, the stormwater flowing from the downspout, but also some sheet flow from the turf grass or driveway surrounding it. So those are kind of the three factors that would help determine the size of the rain garden and the depth as well. And then with plant selection, we are really lucky to have quite a few native plant nurseries in Wisconsin, and some of them have a really great kind of pre-made packages for rain gardens, which not only is very helpful because you can just go on their website and, you know, type in that you're looking for a rain garden plants for a 200-square-foot rain garden that has, you know, clay soils and is in full sun. And bam, you know, it will shoot out. You know, this is the mix that we offer to you. These are the plants that are included in it. They'll give you even a planting scheme, recommendations for, you know, how to situate the plants within the rain garden. And it makes it very easy, and it also makes it cheaper. You know, because if you're picking out your plants individually, you could be paying, you know, $5 a plant or even more in some cases. But if these packages that you buy, you typically only pay, say, like $2 to $3 per plant. And if you're doing all of the work yourself, that's $2 to $3 per square foot is what you're going to pay, versus if you're paying a landscaper to do it, you're usually paying about $15 per square foot for your rain garden.
Right.
And it's
right.
A rain garden installation is a great excuse to have a party.
Yes. Yeah. I will say, though, rain gardens work exceptionally well in full sun to mostly sun. There are some applications for shady areas. The plants, you don't have as much variety in a shadier rain garden, so they do work better in full sun. And I just wanted to mention, the woman who actually initiated the whole native plant movement in Wisconsin many, many decades ago, Lori Otto, realized that, you know, back in the 70s, that we needed to do something about stormwater runoff. So long before rain gardens were ever invented, she just went out and excavated a shallow bowl sort of a thing in part of her landscaping, which was a traditional lot. And long before we actually even had native plant nurseries, she had sources for native plants, and she planted it up, and voila, you know, you have something that helps control stormwater runoff and in fine fashion. So, you know, there are lots of ways around this.
And something beautiful to look at.
Are
there photographs on your website, or I assume where people can try to get a visual sense of what this looks like?
Yeah, I believe we do have some photos on the Root Pike Wind website, which is just rootpikewind.org. But there's more information even on our Respect Our Waters website. So Respect Our Waters is the outreach and education program that we do to help those 21 southeastern Wisconsin municipalities meet their stormwater discharge permit requirements. And so it's respectourwaters.org. You know, Nan was talking about things like people illicit dumping into storm sewers, whether it be paint or oil. We have videos on that website, which are they're funny, but they're also very educational, and they can reach the general public and be entertaining and informative at the same time. And so there's quite a few of those videos addressing different topics, but there's also a blog on there, and there's pages devoted to different topics, and rain gardens is one of those.
Very good. Well, we are just about out of time. We have to get to your calendar of events. Allison Thielen, Program Manager for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. This has been so much fun and really interesting. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here, and we look forward to having you back. Nan, you're going to have to roar through this pretty briskly, but
okay.
We're looking forward to it.
All right. Here is a big, exciting heads up. On July 8th at Seno Conservancy, John Holzwart will be presenting Foraging and Wild Foods. John is essentially a Midwest expert on foraging for wild edibles, and he had a wonderful segment a couple of weeks ago on Outdoor Wisconsin. It's a two-part interview on what he does and his philosophy in life. He's also an amazing artist. He makes beautiful, functional things for people. Registration will be required for this program. To register, you can call 262-539-3222. Again, that's July 8th with John Holzwart, Foraging and Wild Foods. Hoy Audubon, May 24th, is the final evening for the Warbler Walk at Colonial Park. Please meet them in Colonial Park's parking lot at 5:30. Bring your binoculars, obviously dress for the weather. Weed Out Racine and Southeast Gateway Group of Sierra Club are hosting a garlic mustard pull on May 20th in Colonial Park from 9 until noon. And you, yes, you are invited to join them. Dress for the weather, and all of the other equipment will be provided. Riverbend Nature Center, Full Moon Paddle begins June 9th at 7 p.m. Registration is required by calling Riverbend. It's $20 for members, $25 for non-members. All of the equipment will be provided, but they do recommend that you have a little bit of experience with paddling. And that's that.
I'm impressed. All right. And with that, we finish things out. Nan Calvert, always great to have you here, and we'll look forward to seeing you in June. And again, Allison Thielen, terrific to have you here on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gregory Berg. And Monday on the morning show, I'll be sharing my interview with Dan Hampton, who is the author of a fascinating book called The Flight, which focuses on Charles Lindbergh's historic transatlantic crossing, the first time someone had flown across the Atlantic alone in an airplane. We'll talk politics on Tuesday with Professor Yuri Maltsev from Carthage College. And on Thursday, we'll continue the conversation with another Carthage professor, Jerry Mast, from the Political Science Department. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.